thing, everybody. So, for motivation, I was thinking a bit today because we received the news that a young man who had visited the Abbey last December was killed in a bicycle accident in Colorado by somebody who was intoxicated who fell asleep at the wheel. And he was doing a bicycle trip to raise money for a nonprofit organization. I don't remember what organization it was. And I was thinking how this is an example of when an untimely karma ripens and cuts off your lifespan. You know, you have a karmic lifespan, and then some very strong karma ripens and cuts it off. Because I was thinking, you know, the person who was intoxicated, who fell asleep at the wheel in the middle of the day, if he had fallen asleep 30 seconds earlier, our friend would still be alive. If the guy had fallen asleep 30 seconds later, our friend would still be alive. You know, what a... this thing, for all those factors to come together at that very moment where he fell asleep and lost control of the car and our friend was there, you know? So clearly some kind of strong karma that ripened to make that happen. And yet how very sad it was, because it was a person who was young with a lot of potential and a very kind heart. And I think he was in AmeriCorps, or doing, wasn't he?
Catholic Charities.
Catholic Charities, that's right. Yeah, some kind of volunteer thing, you know, helping, I think poor people who were trying to find housing, and he was helping them. And, you know, what a loss that is, not only of his life and for his friends, but for everybody who could have benefited from his kind heart while he was alive. And it shows us really how strong karma is, you know, a very strong karma can just, you know, cut into, cut through so many good circumstances and damage them. And so seeing that and really taking that to heart then lets us have a strong motivation to purify, to abandon creating negative actions. And this brings a certain kind of humbleness. It cuts through our pride of feeling like, oh, I can control everything. It's not going to happen to me, you know. And instead to really say, see, wow, all these causes and conditions are together right now, at this very moment, for me to practice. And I don't know how long the situation is going to be like this. Yeah? And so let's use it now while we have the opportunity. Yeah. And let's support everybody else who has that opportunity, you know, so that they can really use their precious human life at this very moment. By generating bodhicitta, by thinking of emptiness. Because we don't know how long we're going to have this opportunity. Okay, and then we can dedicate especially for our friend. And this week there's been a lot of... is it only me that feels like this week there's been so many, many people writing for prayers, you know, because of sickness and death and difficulties, yeah? So, let's use our life wisely. Okay, so, we've been talking in, or towards the end of chapter 7, which is about how to counteract, you know, this clinging we have to sense objects, how to see through the lure of sense objects. Because in the desire realm, you know, we're completely captivated by sense objects and distracted by sense objects and just creating so much karma every day due to this craving for some sense objects and craving to be free of other sense objects, and then this indifference, you know, towards others. So we're on verse 173 in the 400 stanzas. So this verse is repudiating the accumulation of demeritorious actions. Okay, so before in the previous verses, we were repudiating the accumulation of karma for the sake of power and wealth, then repudiating the accumulation of good karma out of attachment to subsequent wealth, and now repudiating the accumulation of even demeritorious karma. So when they speak about karma, one way of dividing it into meritorious, demeritorious, and then unwavering. So meritorious produces good rebirths in samsara, demeritorious, bad rebirths in samsara. And that's talking about the realm that you're born into. And then immutable or unwavering karma is talking about being born into the form of formless realm, and it's called unwaving or mutable, because when you've through the concentration, the level of concentration that you attained as a human being, then you're born into the corresponding form or formless realm and not any other form or formless realm. So it's unwavering, and that's how it gets its name. It doesn't waver from this realm to that realm. Whereas a demeritorious karma, you know, you may have created a karma to be born in the lower realms, and so it looks like you're headed to be born as a dog, and then something happens and it changes, you know, the circumstances change, and you're born as a cat instead. Yeah? Or you have the karma to be born as a human being in, you know, a certain place, and then different causes and conditions come about and affect that karma, and you're born, you know, a human being in another continent or something. Okay? So, verse 173 reads, "As for a wage earner, merit is in every way just like a wage. How could those who do not want virtue but do what is non-virtuous?" Okay, so what this is saying is, you know, like people who are workers, they work just to get the money, okay? So some people look at good karma as like spiritual money, and they do actions such as generosity and ethical conduct and so on in order to accumulate the good karma so that they'll be rich in their future life or have power or have good relationships or something like that. Okay? So they're seeing the merit as like spiritual money that they can use to buy in quotes good circumstances in samsara. And so this in this verse Aryadeva is saying that the people who are wise don't even want this kind of meritorious karma that leads to good samsaric circumstances. So why in the world would they want demeritorious karma that is, you know, non-virtuous, that is going to lead to a lower realm? Okay, so they've renounced all of samsara up, down, and across. And that's what we're... he's advising that we do too. So if they don't want virtue, then why in the world would they create non-virtue? Yeah, and so, you know, they have a strong in their mind determination not to create either virtue or non-virtue that is polluted by ignorance and leading to rebirth and samsara. Okay, then verse 174 is about the need to abandon polluted actions. So remember, polluted means affected by ignorance or the latencies of ignorance. And the wise who understand reality abandon attachment and reach liberation. So that's what the verse is about. And the verse reads, whoever sees phenomena as like a collection of mechanical devices and like illusory beings most clearly reaches the excellent state. Okay? So only the childish like samsara. Are we childish? We are. We think samsara is kind of cool, you know? I think rich, famous, have a good lover, you know, get all I want, have people respect me. Okay? So we think samsara is kind of cool. So we're childish. So the wise who directly perceive dependent arising as lacking inherent existence, so who perceive anything that arises dependent on other factors as empty of inherent existence. In other words, in the syllogism, they've realized the pervasion. If it's dependent arising, it's not inherently existent. Okay? So those people have realized that, see that all external and internal phenomena, okay? External phenomena means the stuff in your environment that's not connected with consciousness. Internal means things that are connected with a sentient being's consciousness. That person sees all those phenomena as like a collection of mechanical devices made of wood that look like men and women. So I think it's like puppets. Puppets or robots.
Or mannequins.
Mannequins, yeah, mannequins too. Okay? So somebody who, you know, if you have a good understanding of how dependently arising things are empty, then everything that appears to you appears illusory. You know, appearing one way but existing in another way, in the same way that a mannequin, mannequin's a very good example, you know, that a mannequin, you can actually mistake a mannequin for a real person sometimes, you know, depending on how it's lit, or you're just seeing the shadow or the form or, you know, the clothes they're wearing, you go, oh, look at that person. Yeah. And there's no person there. So, you know, that analogy doesn't mean that there's no other people in the world, you know, that when we see things as like illusions, that there's no other people in the world. It just means that just as a mannequin appears to be a real person but isn't, then the phenomena we perceive appear to be inherently existent, but they aren't. But they still exist. They just are not inherently existent. Okay, so they're deceptive, they're false in that same way. Okay, so those who see phenomena as empty of inherent existence and yet appearing, you know, so this whole thing about how emptiness and appearances are not contradictory, then that person will traverse samsara and reach liberation and full awakening. Okay. It's difficult to see that things don't exist inherently, but still they exist. Because we're so used to grasping onto inherent existence that if we think, oh, nothing is inherently existent, then we go immediately to it doesn't exist at all. Okay, because we're so used to believing all the appearances that appear to us that if we start to negate them and we're still on an intellectual level, we very easily go to, oh, well, then they don't exist. Yeah, which is wrong. Yeah, which is wrong. If things were non-existent, there would be no need to practice the bodhisattva path, because nothing would, you know, there wouldn't be any other beings to liberate. But there are other living beings to liberate. It's just that those beings don't exist in the way they appear to us. They appear as if there's a real person there with a real personality. You know, that people don't appear to us as just an accumulation of the parts of their body and the different states of mind and so on. Instead, we think there's a real person somehow in there. We're not satisfied with there just being the five aggregates and the various parts, but we think there's something more that's somehow mixed in but not quite identical with the aggregates. Yeah, and that's what we get attached to. Yeah, we fabricate a person and then get attached to that person or hate that person. But whoever it is we're fabricating, you know, does not exist in the way that we're thinking they do. Okay, then the next verse, 175, talks about when the wise don't enjoy even a higher rebirth out of attachment, their enjoyment of states consistent with aversion is impossible. Okay. So the verse reads, for those who do not enjoy any objects in cyclic existence, it is altogether impossible to take pleasure in this world. Okay, so when we really see through the falsity of samsara, how things appear so alluring, so enchanting, so desirable, as if they had real happiness in them. And so if we get that thing, we get that situation, we go to that place, we're with that person, then because it's inherently attractive and there's real happiness stemming from it, then we're going to live happily ever after. Yeah, as we were noticing in our discussion the other day about fairy tales, nobody ever says what happily ever after means. Yeah. And in samsara, is there a way to live happily ever after? No, it's a fairy tale. Okay, but we believe it. Yeah. So for those who don't enjoy any objects in cyclic existence, in other words, who have seen, you know, let alone the disgusting things in cyclic existence, even the things that appear kind of desirable and alluring, they really aren't, you know. They're impermanent, they're decaying in each subsequent moment. They're, you know, the nature of being unsatisfactory. There's no happiness in them. They're created by our own ignorance and polluted karma. Yeah. They make pollution arise in our mind. You know, so what's there to cling on to? So a person that sees like that, who thinks like that, it's altogether impossible to take pleasure in this world. Now somebody might say, well, that sounds like somebody who's depressed. You don't take pleasure in this world. You know, here are all these beautiful things around you, and they all appear totally unsatisfactory and boring, and you're depressed, and you mope around and don't do anything, and, you know, you really need to go to the doctor because something's wrong with you. That's what it sounds like. No, that's not what we're talking about here. Somebody who's depressed and somebody who sees through the falsity of the alluring appearance of samsara, those people are completely different. Okay? Somebody who's depressed is still craving for some kind of samsaric something and isn't getting it. So they're depressed. This person that we're talking about, a sincere Dharma practitioner, is no longer craving for anything in samsara. Their minds are relaxed, are open, are receptive, whatever comes their way, they're content with it. Yeah, so they have a totally different state of mind. Don't confuse it with somebody who is depressed. Very, very different. Okay? So when the why, those whys and the meaning of reality don't enjoy or crave anything in samsara which is normally enjoyable, how could they enjoy the source of birth, aging, sickness, and death, which normally cause aversion? Okay? So if somebody's not craving for all the various kinds of chocolate in samsara, chocolate being whatever you happen to crave and find delight in, you know, for that person, then they're certainly not going to crave birth, aging, sickness, and death. Yeah, because what's the use? Yeah, there's nothing enjoyable to be found in samsara. And they see that instead, there's states of happiness far superior to what samsara offers. You know, the state of liberation, the state of full awakening, you know, where from your own side you have so much more bliss and fulfillment, and from the side of others where you can do, in full enlightenment as a Buddha, where you can do so much good for the benefit of others. Okay, so having considered the disadvantages of sense objects, this is his closing advice to us, become wise with respect to the meaning of reality and strive to attain unsurpassable awakening. Okay, so having considered the disadvantages of sense objects, that's the first thing we need to do, strong meditation on the disadvantages of sense objects, then become wise with respect to the meaning of reality, so understand that dependently arising things lack true existence. And after you've done that, then strive to attain unsurpassable awakening, yeah, by generating the bodhicitta and then thoroughly cleansing your mind by directly realizing the nature of reality. And so Aryadeva writes a summarizing stanza. Thinking thoroughly about impermanence and dukkha, give up craving for objects such as visual form, the cause for this bottomless, boundless ocean of dukkha, and strive to attain unsurpassable awakening. So that is Aryadeva's heartfelt advice to us. You know? Like the thing that he so much wishes us to understand. His deep gift. You know, the most important gift that you can give somebody is telling them this. Yeah. It's not giving them money. It's not giving them praise. It's telling them, thinking thoroughly about impermanence, how things are disintegrating moment by moment, how they don't last. By thinking thoroughly about dukkha, the nature of things being unsatisfactory, they can't give us any lasting fulfillment or contentment, the things of samsara. Then having thought about that, yeah, then give up craving for objects such as visual form. Yeah? So give up the mind that's saying, I want to see beautiful things. Yeah, I want to see this, I want to see that. You know, I want everything arranged in a certain way, the way that I like it. Yeah. Give up craving for nice sounds, sounds of people saying nice ego-pleasing things or good music or good news. Yeah. Give up craving for nice smells, yeah, perfume or different fragrances or food. Give up craving for tastes, all the different kinds of taste that, you know, things we want to taste. Yeah, how much time people spend talking about food and what they're going to eat and where to get good food and everything like that. And tactile objects, you know, all our craving, I want the room at a certain temperature, I want the bed exactly this soft or this hard, I want, you know, my room to be exactly like this, and, you know, or sexual attachment, nice, you know, we want somebody to, you know, stroke us or whatever. So give up all that attachment because it doesn't lead us anywhere in the long run. Yeah? And instead, yeah, see it as the cause for this bottomless, boundless ocean of dukkha. And instead, strive to attain unsurpassable awakening. So give up what is unproductive and actualize your potential. Yeah, so instead of, you know, putting yourself down, I can't do it, woe is me, blah, 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 see your potential, go for it, and let's make our lives meaningful. Yeah, instead of wasting our time buying more and more tickets on the merry-go-round. Yeah. Remember the merry-go-round? I don't know if they have these anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Do they? Yeah, do they still have them? And, you know, yeah, there's a little, you know, there's a horsey and an elephant and a turtle maybe and different animals, and you sit on the merry-go-round and you go up and down at the same time that the wheel goes round and around. Yeah, and so you can get off your horsey and get on an elephant and get off your elephant and get on, you know, the giraffe, but you're still going round and around and you're still nowhere at the end of the ride, except poorer because you bought too many tickets. Yeah. Then Vasubandhu, yeah, the author of the Abhidharma Kosha, The Treasury of Knowledge. This is a beautiful quotation here. I really like this. Sound is a deer's perdition. Perdition means a source of destruction. Okay? Sound is the deer's perdition. For the elephant, it is touch. Appearance is the moth's perdition. And for fish, it is taste. The fly is attracted to smells. For them, there is but a single cause. Among humans, each individual, both day and night, is constantly destroyed by all five of these. Mm-hmm. How can they attain a happy state? Okay, so this needs to arouse our determination to be free for ourselves and our compassion for all other living beings who are in this situation. So sound is the deer's perdition. They say that deer are attracted to beautiful sounds. Yeah? And I even heard that when, like, they're doing logging, that the deers are attracted to the sound of it. But they often talk about somebody playing, like, a lute, and that the deers follow it, and they get lured into a trap. For the elephant, it's touch. I guess elephants like to touch other elephants, or, you know, with their trunk, or jump into the water and the nice cool sensation of the water. For moth, appearance is the moth's perdition, because moths see the bright candlelight and fly right into it. You know, for them, they don't see danger. They see, like, this beautiful, you know, castle and paradise, and they fly right into it trying to get it and die. Yeah. For the fish, it is taste. The fish bite the hook. Okay. The fly is attracted to smells. You have something that stinks and the fly goes right to it. Okay. So for them, there's but a single cause. So for each of these animals, there's one sense object in particular that they get hooked by. Okay? But amongst humans, each individual human being, both day and night, without any respite, is constantly destroyed by all five of these. Okay? So constantly looking all the time, nice sights, nice smells, sounds and tastes and touches, You know, all the time looking, scanning our whole environment, making plans. What are we planning? You know, we're planning how to have sense pleasure, aren't we? Where can I go that, you know, it's cold here in the winter. I want to go to a nice a place where it's sunny and pleasant. It's too hot in the summer. I want to go to a place where it's cool and pleasant. I want to see attractive people. I don't want to see ugly people. Yeah. I don't want to be involved with anything that's like distasteful. Get it away from me. From the smallest little thing that people do to annoy us. Yeah? We don't even want the smallest little annoying thing that somebody does to, you know, huge kinds of suffering. Yeah. We don't want any of those because we're so attached to pleasure. And so our happiness is destroyed by this craving. Because when we crave, then we create so much negative karma to procure and protect all the sense objects, including the people, the situations, and so on that we want. Yeah. And when you look, you know, it's very interesting because we live closely together. We know each other very well. You know, we may not know ourselves so well, but we know the other person very well. We were supposed to do skits on this today, weren't we? But we can so easily see, yeah, somebody's in a bad mood one day or somebody's angry. Why? Somebody's whining, somebody's complaining. Why? It's all because there's craving for some kind of sense object there, in one form or another. Yeah? And we can see, and it's so easy with other people to see their unhappiness is due to their craving for some kind of sense object. Yeah? But for us, we can't see that, can we? Yeah. When you're unhappy, do you stop and say, I'm craving a sense object that has no possibility of giving me lasting happiness? We don't think that. We think, you know, this person is making too much noise. Get him out of here. Then I'll be happy. Or, you know, I want this kind of food. We haven't had this in so long and I'm really deprived. I need this kind of food. Huh? Or nobody appreciates me. I need some encouraging words of appreciation. Yeah, it's all sense objects, isn't it? Yeah. But when we're unhappy, do we ever say, I'm just craving sense objects that are illusory, that are impermanent, that are the nature of samsara? Do we think that? Yeah, this is what we need to think when we're unhappy. So we're doing Nune this coming weekend. We're going to be deprived of a lot of our usual objects of refuge, the sense objects. And so, you know, at that time, that's when we really have to take refuge in the three jewels. Okay? So normally we don't recognize how we're preoccupied with sense objects. Plus, we constantly and automatically seek to satisfy our senses. All the time. Yeah? Preoccupation with sense objects and our craving for new and stimulating sensory experiences is exploited and reinforced by society. Isn't it? We're always told what you have is not good enough. Where you live is not good enough. You've got to go on a vacation to this place. You've got to go buy this kind of thing. You've got to have a partner that looks like this. Okay? So all of this, our preoccupation with sense objects is really, I mean, this is what the media feeds on and why we get hooked to it. Or we're stirred up with you know, a bunch of unpleasant sense objects. Yeah. Oh, I'm trying to, you know, get my health insurance and the website doesn't work. I want pleasant visual objects. I want the visual object that says your application has been accepted. I don't want error message, you know. As if, you know, I mean, this is what blows my mind. Who in the world has ever rolled out a website where there are no glitches?
Never.
Yeah? Never. It doesn't exist. Anybody who works with computers or does anything with computers knows that you can't try something new without it, and it, having it be perfect and adequate without glitches. There's no such animal. And yet that's what we expect. Yeah. And we're going to complain until we get it. And then, you know, finally when it comes along and our application's accepted, we get 2 seconds of happiness. And then we'll find something else to complain about. Yeah? We spend our life complaining. Oh, now it accepted my application. Oh, but now I don't like that policy. Yeah. Yeah. That policy's too expensive, as if we shouldn't, you know. Yeah. I make $4,500 a year. Why shouldn't I get free health insurance? So, yeah. The more intense our grasping, the greater the anxiety, and the more vulnerable we are to frustration and manipulation. And just, I put that in bold. The more intense our grasping, the greater our anxiety of not getting what we want or of being unhappy. And the more vulnerable we are to frustration and manipulation. So if people are manipulating us, it's because we have a lot of grasping. Our grasping is the little round circle that they can hook and drag us here and drag us there. Because we're grasping at sense objects. Yeah. There was this interesting thing in the paper today. There was a fortune teller in New York who was sued for grand larceny, and she just got sentenced to, they gave her a really stiff sentence, like up to 15 years. It was more than even the prosecutor had asked for. But in the trial, yeah, people who, you know, were having problems in their relationships had gone to her and, you know, she told them this or that or the other thing. And they would write out these enormous checks to her, huge checks of, you know, $27,000 that she would, like, promise to repay if her prediction didn't come true, or they would give her gifts. I mean, extraordinary amounts of things. And she would tell them all this stuff. You know, oh, you were an Egyptian princess in your previous life, or, you know, your relationship isn't going well because in a previous life your family has, you know, hurt his family. And these people, I don't know if they believed it or didn't believe it, but they would write out these checks for enormous sums of money to her. Yeah? And then they asked, later on, they asked for the money back. And then they took it to the police and, you know, she was charged with grand larceny. But I thought, wow, you know, because in the trial, these people were cross-examined and they had to say out loud why. You know, why did you write a check like this to somebody? Did you believe what she was saying? And you can see in those circumstances, somebody who has so much grasping can so easily be manipulated. Yeah. So they wound up, I think, getting a lot, most of their money back, and the fortune teller is going to be put in jail. But it looks to me like somehow the people who fell for it have some difficulty. Yeah, that they need to open their eyes about. Okay, so the more intense our grasping, the greater the anxiety, and the more vulnerable we are to frustration and manipulation. Despite repeated disappointments, we continue to pursue elusive pleasure that these objects seem to promise. Our enthrallment isn't superficial, it's fundamental to us as beings in the desire realm. So we must repeatedly reflect on the true nature of sense objects and their inability to provide lasting happiness. And that will decrease our attachment. And having less attachment means more freedom. Yeah, because when we don't have so much craving and attachment, people can't manipulate us. They can throw out all these hooks, and we don't bite any because we're not looking for samsaric happiness. Okay, so that's chapter 7. There's a lot to think about there, isn't there? Yeah? And so similarly, we see this in ourselves, and we see it in others. Yeah? So when we see it in ourselves, have determination to get out of samsara. When we see it in others, have compassion and want to become a fully awakened Buddha, to be able to lead them out of this too. Okay? So before I go on to chapter 8, any questions or comments?
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about when you have one object, you realize that there's just empty of inner existence, and is it then that you realize everything is also empty of inner existence? Like if, for example, you have, you know, maybe yourself or maybe an object outside.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're asking, if you realize that one thing is empty of inherent existence, do you realize everything is empty of inherent existence? Okay, this actually comes in I think the next chapter it comes. But basically, if your realization of emptiness is inferential, then realizing the emptiness of one object isn't the same as realizing the emptiness of everything. But as soon as you switch your mind to another object, you can realize its emptiness without having to go through all the reasoning again. When you have direct perception of emptiness, then seeing the emptiness of one object directly is the same as seeing the emptiness of all objects directly. Other questions? Yeah.
It seems like that the ignorance puts us through, because, you know, all the suffering that I have gone through in my life, it's like the ignorance brings this kind of amnesia into my mind that despite how deeply the suffering, I forget.
Mm-hmm.
And the same situation will come up, the same craving comes up. It's not like I haven't learned my lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the relationship? I mean, what's the relationship? I know what the relationship is between the ignorance, but there's something about this forgetting about the suffering.
Yeah. Okay, so we've been through enough suffering, and we forget it so that the next time a similar attractive object comes, we're running after it. We forgot that last time this, you know, ended up as a botched situation. And in what it is, it's like the rats, you know, or the mice that are pecking on something, and you get a rice on one thing, so you keep pecking thousands of times and make yourself exhausted, thinking that the next time you're going to get a kernel of rice. You remember that one kernel of rice, so that little bit of happiness you initially got mm-hmm. from the sense object, but then each subsequent time you peck on the thing, you've forgotten that you've had 100 pecks where you haven't gotten anything. All you do is remember the one where you got something. And so you keep going after it. I mean, it's like the people in the slot machines.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly like the people in the slot machines, or the people who go from one relationship to another relationship to another relationship to another relationship. Yeah? And play out the same psychological dysfunctional dynamic in each of them. Because we got some little bit of happiness that didn't last long. It was, you know, the dukkha of change. And then a lot of suffering, and then we forget the suffering and just cling to that little moment. Because we don't, also part of the problem is we don't realize that there's greater happiness. You know, if you haven't met the Dharma, then the only happiness you can imagine having is sense pleasure happiness. You don't even consider that there could be a higher state of happiness. Mm-hmm. Nobody's ever told you. Your family doesn't tell you there's a higher state of happiness. Your family tells you make money and, you know, have a relationship and buy stuff and you'll be happy. Have a good reputation. Yeah. So we're taught this kind of amnesia about the suffering, and given the promise of, well, the next time it will be different.
And it's almost like the more that I practice the Dharma and start finding these moments of where my mind is really happy and okay with what is,
mm-hmm.
it's like the addiction is still strong. I can only stay in those Dharma places
yeah.
of contentment and peace with refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's just this craving mind that's still caught up in that
yeah.
addiction to sense objects that
right.
comes in and just sort of totally isn't the default mode still.
Right, right. Yeah, the craving mind in default mode that is so well habituated.
Mm-hmm.
So strong in our mind. We have such a habit of that. Of what's next? What's the next sense pleasure? What's the next thing? What's the next thing? And that's like automatic for us. And so the only way to disrupt it is really by doing very strong meditation on impermanence and the nature of dukkha. You know, and eventually selflessness and emptiness. It's the only way to disrupt it. Yeah?
I wonder sometimes, you know, we talk about the fact that we've had 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 meals today being a result of our past generosity and so forth. And sometimes I think that here in our country and in our world, we can get whatever we want so easily. Mm-hmm. But this is actually not a result of some sort of virtuous karma at all, because it's such a trap. You know, we don't,
mm-hmm.
I mean, because we can get it,
mm-hmm.
we're even more addicted and
yeah.
I don't
okay.
know, it's a thing to play with in my mind.
Right. Well, they, when you have too much pleasure,
mm-hmm.
your mind is distracted by the pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, like, rebirth in some of the Deva realms is not so desirable, you know, if the pleasure just distracts you. On the other hand, if you have too much misery, you also can't practice because you can't pull your mind out of the misery. So they usually say in a human realm you have a good balance of happiness and misery. But sometimes we do get lost in the happiness because it seems like we can continually get whatever we want, especially here. But then when things don't go right, we get lost in the misery and we feel like nothing in my life is going right.
Mm-hmm.
So again, our extremist mind, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Can you say something about the role of gratitude?
So the role of gratitude, yeah, gratitude's important, isn't it? Yeah, I think gratitude helps us not to be so attached to things and to realize that happiness arises due to causes and conditions. Because when we feel gratitude, we see that other living beings are part of the causes and conditions of our well-being. Don't we? You know, with gratitude, it isn't this feeling of, I'm entitled to it and it happened without any causes and conditions. It's a feeling of, oh, you know, this person was like a big player in my having happiness. Yeah, so I feel grateful. And there's a certain kind of humility that comes with gratitude in that way, because we see that it kind of takes the steam out of this feeling of a big I that's in control, that can rule everything.
It's a little bit closer to reality.
Yeah. I was thinking about it today, you know, how, you know, you can have two people in a room. One person's dying and the other person's healthy. And there they are in the same room. It's like everything in their environment is exactly the same, except one is living for at least a little while longer, and the other one is actively dying. And you know how you can look at that and feel like, wait, but I should, you know, if I'm the one who's dying, I should be able to control this situation and be exactly like the other person sitting in the room, because we're equal sitting in this room and having the same environment. You know, you could have this thing like, it's so unfair and I should be able to do something about it. I should be able to will myself. Yeah. And then to realize, hey, I can't, because the causal energy is already in the process of ripening. And once it started ripening, you can't unripen it. You know? And that there is no controlling I that can, you know, just by my own willpower change my situation when that karma is actively ripening. So that gets rid of that, you know, that feeling of, you know, of I. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My mind struggles with the analogy of seeing people like mannequins, because that's my attachment to, I don't know, something, it just feels so cold. I don't know, there's a part of my mind that maybe wants to see. I don't know, maybe I'm just looking for a guide to how to work with that analogy.
So the analogy of mannequins doesn't particularly inspire you, because a mannequin appears like a mechanical device, not as like a living being. Okay? But if you can imagine, well, what about a scarecrow? If you saw a person in a field, and, you know, it's really a scarecrow, but you can you imagine thinking that it's a real person? So if you can imagine that regarding a scarecrow, can you imagine something going wrong with your senses and thinking that a mannequin is a real person? Yeah.
So that's primarily to see that our mistaken...
our mistaken perception, that something is one thing, but we're thinking it's another thing. We're thinking a mannequin is a living person. We're thinking a rope is a snake. We're thinking a scarecrow is a living being. Okay? Does that help?
Yeah, yeah? I think it's the mind that's grasping it. Then it falls into thinking, oh, the person is a mannequin.
Oh, no. The meaning isn't the person is a mannequin. You know what might be a better example? Take a person on a TV screen or on a computer screen. When you look at that screen, it looks like a real person, doesn't it? Yeah? And you relate to that person on the screen with your emotions, don't you? If that person's crying, you know, you get stirred up. If that person's laughing, you get stirred up. Is there a real person in that screen? No. No. Yeah? We're thoroughly deceived. Okay? So that kind of example might work better with us, you know? It's more familiar, and actually we can see so clearly how we get emotionally attached to figures on a screen and get so emotional about what's, you know, what we see on a screen.
There's an example somewhere, I don't remember where, but it said when you're working with this, that if you remember being in a movie show, and turn around and look at the projector.
Or get up and walk out of the movie theater. It's like, yeah. It's like, oh, I was so involved in that. It still feels like it's real. It still feels like it's happening. But, you know, it wasn't real. And in fact, the whole thing is starting all over again with the next showing of the movie. Yeah. When I was in college, I worked at a movie theater where Midnight Cowboys was playing. I saw Dustin Hoffman die so many times because I had to go into the theater at the very end of the movie and open the doors for everybody to come out. Yeah. Oh, there it is. It's happening again. That's all I remember of the movie. I don't even remember the plot. Anything. There he is. Okay, so we just have a few minutes. We'll just start chapter 8. So chapter 8 is showing the methods of fully training the student's mind stream, making it receptive to the development of spiritual paths. Okay, so before we've talked about impermanence and dukkha and foulness and, you know, the gross lack of self. We've talked about, you know, the bodhisattva deeds, how we have to eliminate afflictions to do them, how we have to get rid of the attachment that impedes us, how that we have to see through the allure of sense objects. And so now we're getting to the point of showing the methods of fully training the student's mind stream, making it receptive to the development of spiritual paths. So this is the last chapter of when we're talking more about the method side of the path, and it's easing us into the next 8 chapters, which are going to be about the wisdom side of the path. Okay? So the first verse, 176, is why afflictions can be abandoned. So Job Lowe comes back and he says, how do we escape from the bondage of desire which we've been accustomed to since beginningless time?
Yes.
Okay, so that's our question, isn't it? Yeah, from the last chapter, that is our question. So Aryadeva says, just as friendship between people who disagree does not last long, desire does not last long when all things false are recognized. Okay. So a friendship motivated by desire between people who don't get along and who disagree, yeah, that friendship is not going to last long. Okay. Because they see things in two very, very different ways. Yeah, they want very different things. So similarly, desire, yeah, does not last for an adept who recognizes the faults in all the external and internal things which give rise to the many unwanted consequences. So somebody who has really done some serious meditation about the first seven chapters, yeah, they're not going to be best friends with sense objects. Yeah, they're going to be the mouse who says, I remember that most of the time I haven't gotten any rice. Yeah. Yeah, the adept is the mouse that says, most of the time I didn't get any rice. And I got myself exhausted trying to, you know, pecking, trying to get rice that never came. I'm stopping that. I'm going to look around for something better. So this is a smart mouse. So this is a smart adept. The adept who recognizes the faults in all external and internal things which give rise to many unwanted consequences. So when investigated, attachment's root is found to be unstable, and thus we can get rid of it. Okay, so the basis for attachment is unstable because those objects do not always give us pleasure. Yeah, we don't always peck and get the rice. You know, that it's not just a thing of pecking and getting happiness. There's so many causes and conditions that need to come together. And when you're depending on happiness that depends on constantly creating causes and conditions, you're sentencing yourself to exhaustion. Okay? So that's why they say nirvana, which is an uncompounded state that doesn't depend on causes and conditions, why nirvana is peace. Okay? Because you don't have to keep creating one cause after the other after the other. Once you've realized or actualized nirvana, there it is. Okay? Okay, so we'll stop here and we'll, next time, verse 177. Okay? So, lots to think about, and especially with Nune coming up. Yeah? Watch the craving mind, how it works. All the time, you know. I want this, I want this, I want that. Well, I can't have this, I can't have that. So I'm going to write 10 million notes. You know, if I can't have food, then at least can you move your seat down 2 inches? You're too close. You're in my space. You know? Can you prostrate more quietly? I can't have anything to drink. So will you prostrate more quietly? It's really disturbing me. Yeah. Yeah? It's the complaining mind, isn't it? Let's just come back. Oh, I'm unhappy because there's grasping at sense objects. And this person prostrating more silently is not going to make me happy because when they do it, I'm not going to notice it.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it, have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losam's teachings dispel in the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds, always increase. Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niryatayami
Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzing Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Travasti Abbey in the west floor.